I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Eve Lazarus joins me again. She's got a new book out, and it's terrific. Cold Case Vancouver, the city's most baffling unsolved murders, features cases that are unsolved and that provide insight into the social history of the city. And when we're talking about the city, we don't just mean Vancouver, but the surrounding metro area. There are cases in North Vancouver from where Eve joins me from today. We have some of the infamous cases, such as the Babes in the Woods, two children found in Stanley Park in 1953 who were likely killed years earlier. There's the disappearance of Nick and Lisa Massey, an over 20-year-old case, both of whom have never been seen again. The murder of Jenny Conroy is fascinating because after her death, a smear campaign in the press waged by the police cast her in an unflattering light, what with the fact she had given birth to a child out of wedlock some months before her demise. Then there's the case of Robert Hopkins, murdered in East Vancouver in what appears to have been precipitated by his closeted homosexuality. The cases in this book are fascinating and another great way to view this place through its history. Eve Lazarus was previously on for her book Sensational Vancouver, which was a bestseller. She first appeared in 2007 when her book At Home with History, The Untold Secrets of Greater Vancouver's Heritage Houses, was published. Another book she wrote was Sensational Victoria, Bright Lights, Red Lights, Murders, Ghosts, and Gardens. She's worked as a journalist and in corporate communications. Her website is at evelazarus.com. This new book is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Eve Lazarus. Ms. Lazarus, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, great to be here.
And congratulations on this book. I hear it's doing well.
It is. Thank you very much. Yeah.
It's a great book because it's one of these things that and I really shouldn't have read it at night because it's all about murder and mysteries and things like that, but it kept me up, and I really wanted to know more about a lot of these cases.
Well, I think it's a bit frustrating because none of them have an ending, except for the last chapter.
So how do you go about picking the cases that are in this book? I mean, I forgot to count, but it was, what, 20 or so?
There's 19 chapters, 25 murders altogether.
Yeah. So I mean, it must have been a difficult task to narrow them down, because you could have easily written about another 20, 25, right?
Oh, easily. There have been hundreds and hundreds of unsolved murders over the years, and I guess the ones that actually got into the book really chose me in some ways. I was looking for people that didn't live a high-risk lifestyle, so they weren't into drugs or gangs or prostitution, but just sort of ordinary people. And I think that, for me, was really frightening, that they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, mostly, and at random. It could have been anybody.
Yeah, and most of the murderers nowadays are of people who are in those, say, high-risk lifestyles, like gangs. I mean, there are still innocent people that get murdered all the time, people by accident.
Mm.
But the folks in this book, because they're unsolved, that all adds another dimension as to who they were.
Yes. And also, I should add, too, because 9 out of 10 people or murder victims know the person that murdered them. And it's fairly straightforward, I guess, for police to arrest them, but most of these cases are the 1% which were killed by strangers, and a lot of them before, of course, forensics like DNA came out. So they're the most difficult cases to solve.
And we are fascinated with murder, aren't we? I mean, and when we hear of these murders in Vancouver's history, it makes history all the more interesting, doesn't it?
Well, I think it was really important to place the murders in a historical context. And what I mean by that is give them a sort of sense of place and time and talk about what was happening in the larger history of Vancouver, that, you know, especially in the 40s and 50s. And while I was writing the book, you know, people were telling me all the time that Vancouver was such a safer, more gentle, nicer place back in the old days,
yeah,
the good old days. And it wasn't. It was this brutal, brutal, vicious place, and particularly for women, children, immigrants, gay men, it just wasn't safe at all. It was it's much, much safer now, and murder counts have dropped dramatically.
Neil Boyd says in your book that it's not as violent today as it was, say, in the 1970s, and I noticed in the book there are a number of cases from the 70s, and you know, even we just do a look back at some of the famous cases in the 70s. There was a lot happening then. So what does Professor Boyd tell you about where society was then as opposed to now?
Well, I think there were a lot younger men who tend to be responsible for the main part of killings. And he also made the point that so the 50s, 60s, and even up to the 70s, mm-hmm. It was quite acceptable to beat up your spouse or smack your kid in the supermarket. And so as a society, we've become way less tolerant of violence. And so his feeling was that was a lot to do with why the murder counts are dropping now, and we're not as violent.
Yeah, and that's another illustration of just how we've changed as not only a society, but as people. And these sort of, I guess, when we look at the history of violence, the murders in Vancouver, a lot of what encouraged those perhaps have declined as well.
Well, there's also a safety net. When I look at, say, Jenny Conroy's murder in 1944, you're also right in the middle of the war, a particularly violent time. And, after that, the Babes in the Woods and later cases, you've got veterans coming back from the war, they're, PTSD, they're not being treated, there's huge homelessness, and women are losing their jobs to returning vets, and there's no safety net. So for women, say, with children that are unmarried, it was a horrific time.
You touched on the Jenny Conroy case, and that's fascinating because you looked at that case and you followed it to today.
Yeah.
And people that Ms. Conroy, I guess her family that are still living today. And so would you tell us about that case and how you came to it? I mean, I guess you live close to where that all happened?
I do. It's serendipity, really. The book had gone off to my editor and was finished. Mm-hmm. And I got an email from Diane Eady, and she's the reference historian at North Vancouver Museum and Archives. And I spent a lot of time there, and she'd said, look, I've just had this album that's been given to me. It's a family album with all these pictures, and I've done a bit of digging, and it turns out it was owned by Jenny Conroy, and she was murdered in 1944, and her murder was never solved. Are you interested? I said, of course. So I, dived in my car, raced down there, and looking through this incredible album with Diane, and it was kind of like this mystery album, because it came through West Vancouver Archives, but no one really knows how it got there, or who put it there, or how long they've had it. So it had all these really interesting dimensions to it. And I said, oh, it's too bad the book's finished. And so I took a photo of Diane holding the album, and I wrote up a thing on my blog about this. And the next day I got an email from Jenny's niece, Debbie, who happened to read my blog and said, oh, that was my aunt. And she had an illegitimate daughter, and I'm in touch with her. Would you like to speak to her? She's now 71 and living in New Zealand. And I said, yes, I would absolutely love to speak to her. So Debbie connected us. And after I talked to Mary, who had done so much research on her biological mother and her family and had come to Canada in 2003 to trace all that, had got adoption records and all of this sort of thing, I'd sort of emailed my editor and said, look, this is such a great story. I'd really like to get it in. And she said, oh, sure, you've got a week. So it was just, most of these profiles took me months and months to put together. So this became a real collaborative effort with Jenny's family. And, when I said some of the victims chose me, Jenny in particular, I think, really wanted to get in this book. And I felt that she'd been really wronged. And as you mentioned in the introduction, she was just brutalized in the media for being an unwed mother, and the police had leaked this and, really blamed her for her own murder. It was just really, really horrible. And I felt like I could do just a little bit to write that for her and tell her story, because she was such an amazing woman, sort of a Rosie the Riveter that worked at the shipyards and managed to hide her pregnancy in North Vancouver in 1944, which to me, it's just unbelievable. I mean, you can't hide anything now, let alone back then, but managed to, save a family from what would have been the scandal of the pregnancy and go along and, all by herself and have the baby adopted out and do everything wrong. And then to be murdered just a couple of months later, it was just a really, really sad, fascinating story to me.
Yeah, what's fascinating as well is the you mentioned the press account. and just the smear campaign, because I guess there was a bottle of whiskey that was found at the murder scene, and the implication of that was that she was drinking with whoever killed her and probably was asking for it.
Exactly. And when it turned out that, of course, she was meeting her family at her brother's house for a late Christmas, you know, dinner,
yeah,
a couple of days after Christmas, and she literally walked to the foot of Lonsdale to catch the bus, missed it by less than a minute, and then had started walking, and it looks like she's been picked up along the way, and whoever picked her up murdered her.
Yeah. Do you find having looked at these cases, I mean, this is a sense that I get, that there was a lot of bungling that happened and on the part of people investigating.
I'm not sure if it was so much bungling, although that did happen, but a lot of it, when you look back, it was 44, we got DNA in 96, so it was 50 years before we even thought of DNA. A lot of the things, the murder weapon, the clothing, the things that had blood all over them, just were thrown out. They weren't seen as having any value. And that's been a real problem now for detectives looking to solve the cases these days, because there's nothing to type DNA on.
Mm-hmm.
There was definitely an attitude, I believe, that some cases were more worthy than others,
yeah,
Jenny not being one of them. As an unwed mother, I felt, you know, they didn't seem to believe it was worth their time. But even when we jump ahead to 1996 and we look at Muriel Lindsay, she was a 40-year-old postal worker that was murdered in her West End boarding house. She was bipolar, and the impression her brother got was she really wasn't worth their trouble. You know, she was just,
yeah,
another sort of person with problems living in the West End, and he felt that they didn't do a good job in investigating her murder, and it's still unsolved.
Yeah, and it speaks to, I guess, the lack of confidence that some people have as to police and investigators in this part of the world. I mean, we've seen that with the Picton case,
mm,
and what's happened in the downtown East Side over the last few decades in terms of what police think is a priority in terms of investigation.
Yeah, no, I think that's completely correct.
Yeah. In terms of bungling, the Charles Head matter, because there are a number of at least two or three in your book that he's linked to, perhaps, and they couldn't really connect the dots, because even though he was in prison for something else, they couldn't figure out if he was on parole that day that at least two of the murder victims in your book went missing.
Mm.
And that's just poor, I guess, records keeping on the part of corrections facilities in this part of the world.
Well, disgusting. Apparently also a lot of bribery went,
yeah,
on as well with the guards. But in that particular case, I mean, this is a guy that was a dangerous offender. He was locked away for life. He had raped, he was a pedophile, and 5 years after being sentenced to life in prison, he was out on his third weekend unsupervised pass in 1972. I mean, just boggles the mind, doesn't,
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
And they believe that it was a revenge killing, this little girl, Tanya Bush, a 7-year-old girl. Her father was a prison guard, and that he was convicted of her murder in the end. And it seemed like a pretty well slam dunk, although he was convicted solely on circumstantial evidence. I think the main point to that, he never should have been out of jail. He was a bad dude, and, you know, whether he did kill Tanya or not, he should have been in jail. But the real problem was there were, in 1967, a little girl, 7-year-old girl, had been snatched from her farmhouse in Cloverdale,
uh-huh,
to be taken. And her body was found the next day close by. And exactly 2 years later, Evangeline Arzacon, another 7-year-old girl, was snatched on her way home from school on the west side. And her body was dumped very near Tanya's. It wasn't found for near Nancy Johnson, the little girl from,
uh-huh,
Cloverdale. And then, of course, 2 years later, Tanya Bush, and they found her body very close to the other two girls. And there were so many similarities to the murders, it really seemed that it was the same guy,
yeah,
that killed him. And as you said, when they looked to see if he was in or out of jail. The records were so badly kept, they had no idea.
Yeah, and I brought up the Bush case because I went to Charles Dickens Elementary just like she did. I didn't go until, say, 25 years after, but I remember even as a kid, people would talk about that, about her being abducted off or lured, I guess, off the playground at the school there.
Yes.
And it really is, I mean, because of it does affect people. I mean, you know, just being in the same neighborhood, say. People talk about these cases, don't they? It's just fascinating that they remain unsolved as they have.
Well, I've got two of them from North Vancouver. Brenda Young was a 38-year-old mother of four kids, lived in Deep Cove, and she was murdered, stabbed to death in her store at the bottom of Lonsdale in the middle of the day. 6 months later, a 16-year-old girl was walking home from a party and was killed similar fashion, just near her home. So 40 years have gone past, and I was told about these stories from my neighbours, and my daughter, Ed's best friend's mother, had always said, you know, don't you go walking home alone from school. You know, I knew this girl that was murdered and all of this stuff. So I had that in the back of my mind when I started looking and sort of doing the outline for this book.
Yeah.
And so I found all these people that knew and were still affected by this, you know, horrific murders 40 years later. One of my daughter's friend's father was the girl's boyfriend, a 16-year-old boy. And, you know, it's still so. He was one of the suspects, and he was able to talk to me for the book about what it was like to be a suspect, what it was like not to have walked his girlfriend home and live with that sort of guilt for the rest of his life. And when DNA came in, he was one of the first lining up to give his DNA. But it's tragic that one is still not solved.
Yeah. You mentioned just the connections that we all have, and I guess it shows what a small town this actually is. I was talking about the book with a friend of mine, and he said that he'd gone to school with Nick Massey Jr.
Ah.
And so, I mean, he didn't know Massey Jr. very well, but we obviously know that case because that was big news in this part of the world 20 years ago when they first disappeared, right?
Exactly, yeah.
He was a stockbroker, was he, or a banker?
He wasn't a stockbroker. He was a banker. He was a private banker for the Bank of Montreal and had been for 35 years. He'd retired, but while he was at the bank, he looked after some, you know, pretty heavy high rollers like Murray Pezum and Nelson Scalbania, and lived a pretty nice lifestyle, you know, connected with them on a banker's salary. And after he retired, he became a director for one of these VSE sort of sketchy kind of companies.
Yeah.
And was supposedly meeting a potential investor with his wife at Trader Vic's, which was an old haunting ground for brokers and people connected on the stock exchange back in the 80s and 90s, part of the Western Bayshore now. Mm-hmm. And he never turned up. So a couple of days later, I think, his wife's sister had gone to the house, and they'd found the car there and the cat locked inside and passports there. But it's still a mystery. They still, you know, talking to the police now, it's still a missing persons case because they never found the bodies.
Mm.
And with his connections, they feel it's possible that he could be, you know, off on some beach sipping, you know, away at a margarita. but I think it's far more likely he got in with, the, you know, the dodgy kind of stock exchange people and was murdered.
Yeah, you know, we forget just how big the VSE was back then, and just as you mentioned already, some of the colorful figures associated with that in the 80s and the 90s, and just how colorful that time was.
Well, there were a lot of people getting shot in the head in their cars, but most of them were left there for somebody else to clean up. But I think the Matthews were the only ones that sort of really disappeared without a trace.
Yeah. DNA, I guess, and technology like that really has reduced the numbers of unsolved mysteries, murders, hasn't it?
I think it's helped. But again, you know, with these really old cold cases, there isn't always the DNA to check it on, and it also has to be in the system.
Yeah.
And unless they've been caught for doing something else, it's not. So it's a wonderful tool to help, but it's certainly not the cure-all.
And how many of the cases in this book are unsolved simply because there isn't enough evidence in terms of getting a conviction or pinning it on a certain on the person who did it, the perpetrator?
It's really hard to say because the police won't talk to media about open cases.
Uh-huh.
And when they talk about sort of unsolved cases, they say they never close them, they're always open. But we know that's not really true.
Yeah.
Some are quite selective and some are reinvestigated yearly and others haven't been looked at. Like Jenny Conroy's family has never been contacted in 70 years. They'll say that while some of them are unsolved, they're not necessarily unresolved. And by that they mean they know who did it.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't have the evidence to bring them to trial. Or it might be that, you know, that the guy has died.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's still unsolved because it hasn't gone to trial. Or it may be that the prosecutor has decided that it's not in the public interest to bring it to trial. And that may be because it's a serial killer and they've already got him on, and I say him because I think it's almost always a him,
right,
on several other murders or even one other murder. So they believe it's not worth going through a trial. And I find that really hugely problematic because the family never gets closure.
Yeah.
And if the guy's only being, you know, caught for one murder, he could well and truly be out in 14 years. If he's a serial killer, there's much more chance of keeping him in for life where he's not going to do it again.
You mentioned earlier the last case in the book, and I thought that was great that you included that because that was a cold case that got resolved.
Yeah, and for me, well, first of all, it was nice to have something with an ending.
Mm-hmm.
But also because I didn't want to make it look like, you know, it was a police bashing book or police are incompetent, because that's certainly not what I was trying to do. As I mentioned earlier, you know, these are the 1%, the hardest possible cases to solve that I've picked for the book. But it was really interesting to me to go through with this detective and look at the lengths that police will go to solve a cold case, particularly when it's a child. And this was a 15-year-old boy from Montreal that hitchhiked to BC in 2000 and was murdered in Kamloops. And they found the guy purely by luck. He was doing a purse snatch on Davie Street, was caught by police, fingerprinted, and his partial fingerprint led to a match from the 2000 murder. It still wasn't enough to get a conviction. Police ended up following the guy around until they could get some DNA cast off, found that was conclusive hit to his DNA. But it still wasn't enough, and they ended up launching this incredible Mr. Big sting, where RCMP officers pretended they were part of this criminal organization, and they got the guy, you know, to believe that he was part of the gang and was rising through the ranks. And they got him to confess to the murder.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went to trial. So it's unbelievable, you know, what police will do. On the other hand, you don't want to see an Ivan Henry case where this guy's suing the police for being thrown in jail for 27 years for rapes that he didn't commit. So it's a fine line that we walk, I think, with these.
Yeah, and have you talked to police in terms of the tips that they receive? I mean, there is a line that people can call if they have, you know, say a tip on a case. Do they still get tips on some of these unsolved murders over the years?
They do, and it's so important. And people think, you know, I've even had people that I've interviewed for the book say, "Oh yeah, I saw this guy follow her."
Yeah.
40 years ago, and I said, "Well, you told the police, right?" No, I called them, but they didn't call me back. You know, stuff like that. I mean, literally, it might be nothing, but it could potentially solve a 40-year-old murder. Police want to hear about anything like that, and that's really how these cold cases have been looked at again. They formed a unit called the Provincial Unsolved Homicide Unit in the 90s, and it was made up of Vancouver City Police and RCMP and other jurisdictions solely to look at cold cases and try to solve them. But they have to have something new to go on, and that might just be someone's tip.
Yeah. As a historian, Eve, and we're seeing the city change dramatically and rapidly, we need to know about the history of this place, don't we, as we move forward?
I think it's hugely important, and I think it, this is a, another way that we can tell stories about the history and look at it, you know, not from a traditional point of view, but from all the good, bad, and ugly that Vancouver was, and some of these stories are also the most interesting, I think.
Yeah. What's next for you?
Well, I'm working with the North Vancouver Museum and Archives on a project on the waterfront. It's a new interactive exhibit, and that's keeping me really busy, and it's just a nice change to get my head clear of murder.
Well, I've asked you this before, but I'm sure as you're writing about these cases, looking into them, talking to say, the Conroy family or other people like that, do you feel like a detective sometimes and have an idea as to who did this and actually solve the case for your part?
I think I sort of felt a bit like a detective, particularly when it came to tracking down some of the families, because that was really important to me to hear from their side what had happened and to really talk about the person and not just about their murder. But no, I don't think I unfortunately got close to solving anything at all.
Well, what's particularly sad was I can't remember the case now, but you'd mentioned this detective. And they swore they knew what happened, and they went to their grave thinking what had happened. But you know, years later, some other evidence comes up, and I guess disproved whatever thought they had on the case.
That was the Babes in the Woods.
Yeah,
that must have been horrific. And that was another thing, actually, when talking about how DNA can change the face of an investigation.
Yeah.
It didn't solve the case, or it didn't identify the children. But what it did, the police in 1953 determined that it was a boy and a girl from the skeleton remains that were found in Stanley Park.
Yeah.
And when DNA came on the scene in 96, the Unsolved Provincial Homicide Unit took another look, and they found that when they tested the DNA, they found that it was two boys from different fathers. So they figure if they'd known that 50 years before, they could have solved, you know, the case.
Yeah. It's just you think of the what ifs and the sort, and you know, you wonder 50 years from now whether there'll be some resolutions to the cases in this book.
Well, you certainly hope so, and I think a lot of them are really solvable.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, you know, the unsolved unit are looking into some of these. I have no idea what they're looking into, but I'm hoping they are.
Yeah, as ever, Eve, you're doing great work. Congratulations on this book, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
The same. Yeah, best of the season. Happy Christmas and all that.
Thank you.
The website for more, evelazarus.com. The book is called Cold Case Vancouver, The City's Most Baffling Unsolved Murders. Do get it. It's a great read. It'll keep you up at night, and you'll want to read more of Eve's work. She's a great writer. It's published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Its author, Eve Lazarus, joined me on the line from North Vancouver in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.